Refinance activity is heating up. Are your originators ready to capture the opportunity? Join Optimal Blue experts Jared Sammy and Brennan O'Connell on October 7th at 1 p.m. Central for a live webinar, Refi Revival: Stay Ahead of the Curve with Originator Intelligence. You'll discover how to surface high-potential refinance leads from your closed loan data, reconnect with past borrowers using timely, data-driven outreach, and cut research time from 30 minutes to just one click. Register now with the link in the show notes for this episode to give your team the edge in quarter four and beyond. In case you missed it, Optimal Blue has announced the dates for its 2026 summit. Join us February 23rd to 25th at Talking Stick Resort and Conference Center in Scottsdale, Arizona, for a client-exclusive event packed with strategic insight and innovation. Attendees will gain early access to Optimal Blue's latest generative AI and automation tools, dive into expert-led sessions on pricing, compliance, and more, and experience hands-on demos of new capabilities. Plus, it's a chance to connect with capital markets pros, integration partners, and mortgage insiders, all while gaining actionable strategies to maximize profitability and sharpen your competitive edge. The Optimal Blue Summit, where proven mortgage expertise meets modern innovation to shape what's next. Early bird registration is now open at summit.optimalblue.com. Space is limited, so register today. Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for timely market analysis and expert commentary from Optimal Blue. I'm Jeff McCarty, Vice President of Product Management at Optimal Blue. As you may notice, Jim's not here today, but joining me are Vimy Vasudeva, Managing Director at Optimal Blue, and Alex Hebner, our resident economic guru. We'll also have a special guest today, Mike Vogue, Head of Corporate Strategy here at Optimal Blue. Mike is going to lead us through the current dynamics of the non-QM market. Let's dive into today's episode. Welcome, Alex and Vimy. All right, so we got a lot to get through this week. We've got a super busy week on the economic calendar. Some people are calling it, one of the busiest weeks in the past few years. We've got the Fed meeting on Wednesday, of course, and then we have employment numbers coming out Friday. Plenty of other things probably going on throughout the week with all the tariff talk. And then second half of the podcast, we'll bring on Mike Vogue, as we mentioned. And he spent the past several months, talking a lot about looking through the non-QM market, figuring out what's going on, doing a lot of research, understanding what products are out there. So Mike's going to come on and do kind of a non-QM one-on-one 101 for us and really unpack that market from the ground up so that we can understand that a little bit better. So really looking forward to that. But first, let's dig in as we always do with Alex on what's going on in the markets. We've got the OBMMI still at 6.78, 10-year as of midday today. Monday is at 4.41. So, still in a super tight range overall, not a ton of volatility in rates over the past couple of weeks. So Alex, let's probably start off with what's happened recently in the markets. I think the EU trade deal is probably a good place to start, right?
Yeah, I'd agree. I think the EU trade deal that we got over the weekend, there were some rumors floating around late last week in the markets that they were close on a deal for the EU. It's probably the biggest takeaway from the past week or so. We were really light on data last week. So really just looking for developments in that geopolitical arena that's going to move the market. But yeah, looking at the EU trade deal, they're going to be paying a 15% tariff on most all goods. There's certain carve-outs there, a 0% on aeronautical parts and chemicals and some agriculture and higher tariffs still, I think around 50% for steel and aluminum, but 15% for the vast majority of goods. And then spirits, which is a big sticking point for a lot of the Europeans, that is actually still undecided. So that's still to come.
Don't tax my cognac.
Yeah, no, or your wine or your vodka, whatever it may be, wherever it's coming from.
And if that's not your thing, Alex, where do we stand with luxury goods, which is a little bit more where my focus is on?
I believe those are going to fall under the 15%. So it's going to be a little bit more for that Louis Vuitton bag.
Noted.
Yeah, I saw something that with those still much higher tariffs on steel and aluminum, even with the 15% tariff on EU autos, it still could be cheaper for those EU autos than autos built in the U.S. because steel and aluminum tariffs are still so expensive.
German manufacturers were saying that this could be a big pain point, but you got to keep in mind that if they make a certain number of components inside the United States and then make the vehicle inside the United States, which there are VW plants in America already, they could, you know, get away from tariffs in that regard. But when you're looking at like the labor situation in the auto market in Germany, that's looking like a pretty bleak outlook there. You know, while we're talking about trade, China is still the big outlier. We had that trade framework from the beginning of June that doesn't seem to have stuck too well. They're meeting again this week in Sweden. There's not a lot of details on this yet. It seems to be expected by the market that there will be an additional 90-day pause. They'll come away with, you know, quote unquote, positive feedback. And then they're gearing towards an eventual summit between Trump and Xi where they'll sign a big trade deal. But really no movement on that front so far. I just expect a 90-day pause again as we head towards that August 1st deadline on Friday.
It sounds like Friday is going to be a very big day with respect to the deadline as well as the non-farm payroll report number. Any thoughts on that, Alex?
Yeah, I think in regards to labor in the U.S., Friday is going to be a big one with the U.S. non-farm report, expecting 102,000. Slightly down from last month. And then just keeping an eye on those initial jobless claims each week as well, as I've been noting each week. Thursday, initial jobless claims looking, the expectations around 221. If we see north of, you know, 230, approaching 250, again, that's going to be a sign that the labor market is under pressure. But the last few releases have been pretty strong after we got the weaker readings in June.
Okay, so the other big thing in the news last week, our favorite topic, is the Powell Trump drama and their visit to the new Federal Reserve buildings. It's probably a good segue to talk about the Fed announcement on Wednesday. But anything we care to comment on from the visit last week?
Yeah, it seemed to just be a rehashing of the issues that Trump has raised with Powell and that Powell has demurred on or said I'm doing my job to the best of my ability and how it's historically been conducted. I would say more so than anything, almost like there were more internet memes and jokes that came out of it. They looked a little goofy in their hard hats in the construction site. You know, Trump tried to get Powell with a gotcha. He pulled out, you know, a bill essentially for the costs of these renovations had been. And Powell gave it a squint and immediately ID'd the line item that he's like, oh, this building that's on here, this was completed a couple of years ago. Why is this on here? You seem to be inflating your numbers. Again, it really just seemed to be a continuation of their public spat. The Trump administration's under a little bit of pressure right now, Trump specifically on non-economic factors, i.e., you know, the Epstein stuff. It really just seems to be a continuation of that public drama to kind of steer away from other things. I wouldn't say there were really any developments that came out of it.
No developments other than the memes, as you noted. In fact, I was prepared for this segment with my son's hard hats. I was hoping that the rest of you would also be sporting hard hats, just, you know, on theme with
Rossi. I searched around for one. I couldn't find one before the call.
No hard hats, no pieces of paper in our pockets, no side eyes. We're directing it at each other. So a little bit more civil than that exchange, perhaps, here. I think tying it back, though, I've been obviously watching Pulte's tweets a lot recently, right? Tying it back to housing, Bill Pulte has sort of been at the forefront of the administration in terms of, you know, the call for lower rates, pretty aggressive calling for lower rates and Powell's firing. He did have a after the visit, he had a much more benign tweet than he had the previous part of the past couple of weeks. So, you know, maybe his rhetoric is dying down a little bit as well after that visit.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think one of the bigger takeaways with Pulte this week was he was tweeting that there's been this kind of open question mark in regards to the agency's exiting conservatorship. And he seemed to kind of slam the door shut on that idea, which I think a lot of people in the industry were expecting. We had a call with Kevin Jackson a couple months ago now and just how it didn't really make sense for the federal government to throw all this money away, essentially, by releasing these agencies from conservatorship. Seeing Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac stock price retreat on that news, it was getting bit up a little bit just on the expectation that they could be released and those profits could be seen in a public arena.
And again, they've got to see that is not a path to lower rates either, which is one of their main objectives. So what else should we be looking forward to in the announcement, the Fed announcement this week? You know, pretty much assuming there's not going to be a rate drop, right? But what should we be looking at besides that?
There will be FOMC decision and presser on Wednesday. Don't expect anything from it, as you just said, Jeff, in regards to rate cuts. Maybe there'll be some curveballs in the press conference. I'll be sure to watch that, but I won't really hold my breath on any sort of rate cut. For the rest of the week, though, tomorrow, Tuesday, we have consumer confidence. It's expected to rise, I'd assume, on just us seeing more and more trade deals getting done. Both consumer and business outlook, I would expect to improve with these trade deals getting done. Not because, you know, they're going to make things necessarily cheaper, but I think the confidence that having a deal done and the question marks that evaporate when these deals get done is good for consumer and business confidence. So that's expected to be a little bit higher on Tuesday. Wednesday, we'll get some ADP employment numbers. Again, I'd give more credence to the initial jobless claims on Thursday, in addition to the non-farm numbers on Friday. Q2 GDP is on Wednesday as well. That one's expected to spring back from the really weak reading we saw in Q1. 2.3%, which would leave us for the first half with around 1% GDP growth. So well below what we're expecting. But as we talked in depth several months ago, how Q1 GDP readings can be quite weak. Aside from that, finally, on Thursday, the PCE inflation metric. So it comes a day after the FOMC decision. But again, that inflation metric, the PCE number, is what the Fed looks to mostly for their inflation reading. So if we see that pop, I would expect it to really kill any expectations for that rate cut in September.
Wow. A lot going on. Yeah. Yeah.
Sounds like we'll have a lot to talk about on next Monday's podcast.
Yes, I agree.
One thing interesting tied up in all that is looking for any dissenting opinions. You know, we expect Waller to dissent on Wednesday. You know, Waller, for a variety of reasons, right? Do we think Waller's, you know, gunning for the new job? Or, you know, I think there's a lot of substance in Waller's comments about why lower rates are being called for. You know, looking, you know, if you look at especially the employment data one way and seeing that start to weaken, you know, trying to get ahead of that weakening employment data. And so, you know, based on Waller's comments, any other dissenting opinions and some of the employment data coming out this week, you know, that could provide a roadmap for, you know, when and how the Fed lowers rates. Well, good stuff as always. Thank you, Alex. Thanks for your insights. And yeah, as Vimy said, plenty to talk about next week, and looking forward to that. So
yes, looking forward to dissecting the numbers.
All right. So as promised, we're going to get into some non-QM discussion. And to do that, we're going to welcome in Mike Vogue, a long overdue first visit to the podcast, first of many, I'm sure. Mike is the head of corporate strategy here at Optimal Blue. And in that role, Mike's responsible for our 3 to 5 year vision of the company, our data business, our partner business, and M&A. So Mike's out there in the industry a lot, talking to a lot of different folks, hearing about what's coming up. And obviously non-QM is kind of the hot topic of the industry right now. So Mike, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Jeff. I've been patiently waiting my invite to the podcast. So really happy to be here.
Yeah, excited to have you.
Well, it's especially exciting because Mike is also a co-host of the other podcast that Optimal Blue presents. So
it's the crossover.
Crossover we've all been waiting for, I'm sure.
Great. Well, Mike, we're excited to talk to you about non-QM today. 6 weeks ago, we actually hosted a podcast with a segment entirely dedicated to non-QM, given that at that time, there were several industry conferences that Optimal Blue was attending, and the hot topic was non-QM. And we know that you have had your entire summer dedicated to this hot topic. You've been certainly doing a lot of research and putting together some ideas and plans around pricing and hedging non-QM. And so your visit on this podcast is very timely. And so I'm curious to hear from you. What do you think has driven this surge in the non-QM market recently?
I appreciate it. I mean, and I would actually contend that my obsession with this topic goes back a little bit further. I would contend it started at the Structured Finance Conference in Las Vegas, February of this year. I've been going to that conference the last 2 or 3 years, mostly from the standpoint of, hey, we have a lot of interesting data products that clientele might find interesting. And as I was there, every investor or other tech provider that we talked to was just a buzz with everything non-QM and the non-agency loan in general. And so in plenty of conversations that I had, folks were like, you're in the agency space, you're not in the non-agency space, or unsure if like you're fit to work with us. And I would educate them that we had a lot of information on these loans, but it was not like something that I've ever seen before where folks were like, hey, don't talk to me about this, talk to me about that. And so that kind of sparked a kind of a mission in me to kind of come back to the company and try and think about ways that we could strategize more to help folks think of us more than just an agency conforming loan shop. You know, I think it will take some time to take a step back and actually think about what a non-QM loan is. Like, it's kind of funny, like not many other spots in the world or in the industry you refer to something by what it's not. So it's like an interesting wrinkle from a branding perspective.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to dig a little bit deeper now, because we are just throwing around this kind of generic term, non-QM. And sometimes people don't know what it means. Sometimes maybe they think it means just strictly non-agency, but that's not what we mean either, right? There's a lot of nuances to non-QM once you get into that type of product. So let's start with just what is non-QM by itself?
Yeah, and that's a great point, Jeff. And I'm going to start by talking about a QM loan first and then come back around to non-QM. So like after the financial crisis, you know, Dodd-Frank came about and they set a condition in Dodd-Frank of quantifying loans as a qualified mortgage or not. And if you were a qualified mortgage, that effectively meant you had the backing of the U.S. government, right? Like you were going to get a guarantee fee from Fannie or Freddie or FHA or VA or USDA. And it basically came down to two conditions. Now, people will come back at me and say, oh, there's so much more. But I can make the argument that it all comes back to two things. It comes back to the debt associated with the borrower. Actually, QM mortgages, you have to be below a 43 DTI. And then it comes down to how you actually verify someone's income. So it's not a hard, fast rule that you can't be a W-2 employee and get a QM mortgage, but it greatly, greatly, greatly increases your chance of being approved for a QM mortgage if you have a W-2 that corroborates that you could pay for the mortgage that you're about to get approved for. So to take the inverse of that, a non-QM loan basically means you have a slightly unique kind of like debt story, which we could talk about probably in a couple of examples coming up here. And then also you have a different way of kind of verifying your income. It's not as simple as, hey, here's my W-2, go ahead and approve me. You need some type of alternative documentation to prove that you could actually afford the mortgage you're about to get approved for.
And so, Mike, do you believe that this has really come about in the last several years strictly because of the surge in the gig economy, or are there other factors?
I think that's a part of it. I think the surge in what I would call like non-traditional work definitely plays a component part here. I would also say that I think that we've seen some entrepreneurial increase as well. Like the gig economy kind of might lead you to become an entrepreneur. And one of the most common kind of like non-QM loans is a DSCR loan, or a debt service coverage ratio loan. And that's a really interesting one because it actually kind of forks you off of the income of a particular borrower and actually looks at the rental income spun off from a property, right? So like, I'll get into a little bit more specifics in a second, but think about all the upticks and things like Airbnbs, right? You probably see people on Instagram who have three or four different Airbnbs and they're kind of working on that as a side gig or their prime time gig. And if you think about, you know, what that means is once you get to a certain point of scale, like you could operate this for a profit and they should invest in you like any other business, but it's not the same as getting a W-2 income verified mortgage. And when folks talk about what a DSCR is, it's basically, you know, the income spun off by a property like that, an investment property or a rental property, and divided by your mortgage payments. So for example, if you think you're going to make $115,000 on a mortgage payment on an annual basis, and your mortgage payment on an annual basis is $100,000, well, your debt to service coverage ratio is 1.15. So that means that you're not, you know, anything under 100 is probably, you're probably in a bad spot there. But this gives folks that who are starting to maybe take that spin into more of an entrepreneurial bent from an ownership perspective, it gives them that avenue to that.
That's a really good example, kind of pretty crystal clear, this unique type of income stream, unique type of debt. You had one other example of kind of the two main non-QM types of loans out there, right? The other one being bank statement loans.
Yeah, and I think it goes hand in glove with that entrepreneurial point from earlier. If you're a, again, non-traditional, non-W-2 based employee, and you've maybe sold a business, maybe you just have a lot of money in the bank, right? Maybe you're in a cash intensive business, but you have enough assets to actually cover the mortgage. Again, the W-2 is not saying that you can't get a QM mortgage if you're done with W-2, but it greatly increases your chances if you can. So some folks might go the other route of saying, hey, I have 12 or 24 months of bank statements that show I have the assets to approve me for the mortgage that you want to give me. So it kind of goes to that alternative angle of income verification. And really the only difference for non-QM is that it's the debt and then the income verification piece. And then just to build on that, another non-agency loans, you think of like jumbo loans, and that's basically just anything above the agency conforming high val limit.
That's a really helpful explanation, Mike. So you mentioned in an example that a borrower could qualify for both QM and non-QM, and the non-QM, of course, would be easier. But I feel like this is a good segue into us talking about what are the disadvantages of a non-QM? In other words, how is it priced?
Yeah, it's this is where things get really, really hairy. In the QM world, every QM loan is eligible to be delivered into what they call a to-be-announced mortgage-backed security. It's almost like a generic vanilla mortgage-backed security that's going to settle 3 to 6 months in the future. And it's a very deep liquid market. It's arguably the second largest fixed income market in the world. And the non-QM space doesn't have that same thing. So there's not a backstop. There's not a security that these non-QM loans can be delivered into. That actually makes it very, very minimal from a risk perspective for lenders to create these loans and hold them for a period of months without having that backstop there. And in the QM world, you know, you might have investors that are doing slightly different things, but like that grounding point is what's going on in the to-be-announced mortgage-backed security market. So you can look at pricing day over day, and you're like, okay, it moves in line with the TBA market in most cases. The non-QM world's not that. And we can talk about more specifics there in a second, but it's just that's the main difference is that there's no deep liquid secondary market just yet in that product.
We reiterate that all the time in our Hedging 101s about the agency market is, you know, this TBA market is one of the, if we had the seven wonders of the financial markets, TBAs would probably be up there on the seven worlds because it provides so much liquidity to the agency QM market. And we just don't have that in other types of products, particularly non-QM.
Yeah, it's not like someone can log into a Tradeweb or Bloomberg and see exactly how these things should be priced. It's much more complex than that.
Yeah, and that also, I mean, if there's not this deep liquid secondary market, then you have to deal with a fair amount of risk from the lender perspective, right? And a lot of these lenders, at minimum, have to hold this loan until it's underwritten, right? And then in this space, the investors who are looking for these loans typically want size too. Like they're way less likely to buy a single loan like there is in the agency world. So in most cases, these lenders who are originating this paper might have to wait till they get to $50 million from a UPB perspective before they could even sell it to an end investor. And so that adds additional months of interest rate risk that you have to kind of manage during that period of time, which makes it a difficult task.
So maybe you can break down just a couple of simple examples about how some of these products are being priced today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, and before I do that, I do want to kind of just give you a little state of the union too on like what we see from a data perspective. So like, for example, you go back to the beginning of 24, non-QM loans were about 4% of what we see on a daily basis. And like and another point I want to make is that like conforming loans at that time were about 51, 52%. You fast forward to today, that number is about 9% on the non-QM side, and conforming loans are about 43, 44%. So you've seen this shift where the production's starting to get there. VA loans, for example, are about 10% of our production. So it's starting to nip at the heels of that fourth place from a percentage of where we see production today. And then, you know, conforming 15-year loans are only 2% of production, which makes sense because of higher rates. But just to kind of set the stage there. And then from a hedging perspective, because you don't have TBAs to ground yourself to or in a pricing perspective, you see a lot of folks move towards a model based upon maybe a blended spot on the Treasury curve or the SOFR curve. And so what that effectively means is you're saying, hey, I'll pick the 5-year SOFR rate. I'll use that as my discount rate in a DCF. And they're probably adding a fairly large spread on top of that as well. So you're probably getting somewhere in that 8 to 10% discount range. And you're using that as a component part of the valuation process. And so it challenges lenders to say, okay, well, if they're grounding themselves to some other type of model or some other type of, you know, fixed income rate, well, what do I use to hedge then? If I'm so used to hedging with TBAs, can I still do that today? Jury's a little bit out on that, but there are other securities that folks can use to hedge that risk.
So can you talk through some of the potential hedging strategies and what those securities are?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're doing something, if you knew that the investor that you were delivering these loans to were using a treasury-based model, well, then you could, you know, trade treasury future options, things like that. If you knew that they were going to be based off a SOFR-based model, there are things such as the ARIS swap future that's out there you could use to get SOFR exposure. What I would actually counsel folks is, well, I think a lot of folks in the industry might be using that type of methodology from a standpoint of ease right now. We haven't really seen anything disrupt this space right now. So it's easy to say, hey, I'll pick the 5-year SOFR or the 5-year treasury because generally mortgages are around 5 or 6 years. And I'll use that as my grounding point here. But there are other components that to think about here. These loans have a ton of credit risk in comparison to a SOFR swap or a treasury future. Until we're further notified, the U.S. has never defaulted on their debt. And even on TBAs, like you have the guarantee of the U.S. government behind that as well. A non-qualified mortgage, which I may have blew past this point earlier, is there is no G fee, right? There is no Uncle Sam's not coming to help you. You have to be very comfortable with the credit risk that you're taking on as a lender. Now, plenty of folks are doing this and doing it very well, but it's just you have to think about it in comparison to other points. So could you use some combo of fixed income instruments? You definitely can. And that might help you with the directionality of rates. But when you start to layer on things like prepayment penalties, when you start to layer on things like this credit risk that you're short effectively, there's not necessarily a slam dunk instrument for that right now.
Yeah, minor detail, like you said, that we blew past at the beginning. You know, TBAs certainly provide kind of the baseline pricing to understand, but also, you know, TBAs, you know, ultimately those mortgage-backed securities being, you know, guaranteed by the federal government provides that backstop for the credit risk, for default, for prepayment. All those different things go into TBAs as well. So those are really the two kind of main components to think about as you move into a non-agency, any type of non-agency product, but non-QM in particular here. That's great, Mike. And so, you know, as we kind of put that together, you know, you start thinking about, you know, if you're a lender and you're starting to think about generically, how do I price, how do I hedge those products? It, you know, you have to start having a bunch of different things in your tool belt that you don't need with agency products. And we can go back to one of the things that Vince Zenner said in our podcast a month or two ago. You know, he essentially said that, you know, the era of passive management is over as you get into these products, right? It's much more active management when you start trying to figure out how to price and hedge these products on your own.
Yeah, I mean, Vince sent that one on that nail on the head. Passive hedging is over when you're in this space, and you know we've started to dip our toe in this area as well. And one of the things that this market lacks is daily observable volume. So in, you know, current like agency world, you see the TBA market every day. Folks who are originators are selling loans every day, and you get a ton of feedback over where things are trading. This world, not as much. So you have where you can observe things locked in a product and pricing engine like Optimal Blue, but there's not necessarily this like active flow market from a mandatory perspective being sold every day. You sometimes see things from like Standard & Poor's or Fitch or folks like that who put out details about securitizations. And that's what I referenced earlier, when folks have to get to 50 to 100 mil of size, and then they actually create their own security. It's very similar to if you created your own mortgage-backed security, agency security, but you don't have the G fee, right? You don't have that credit component protect. Oh, you have a credit component where you typically don't have it in that world. And so that part of the world isn't really, there's not really a ton of, you know, accessible data in that spot to see where these things are trading, and it's few and far between, right? You might get a couple a week if you're lucky. So what we've started looking at is the lock volume that we see in our PPE. So we cover, you know, approximately 40% of the volume out there in that space. And then if we've got 10% of that volume, give or take, in that non-QM space, I think that's that might be the most deep and liquid observable data set out there. And so what we've started to do is take that data and then use our existing expertise in the capital markets world, you know, doing discounted cash flow analysis, layering in different Monte Carlo simulations for rates, and basically benchmarking to the observed prices that we see in the PPE to help us solve for that discount rate or that yield that folks are searching for in terms of pricing this stuff. And like all things, once you have a model, you can shock it 50 different ways and you can start coming up with those risk metrics. And once you have those risk metrics, then you can make decisions on, hey, do I hedge with TBAs? Do I hedge with this other security over there? And you can kind of treat it like almost any other asset that you would see from a normal like pricing and hedging perspective. But you have to be able to go back to that observable data set and that model, which I think is really important.
That's super important. And so, Mike, that leads me to wonder, given that you mentioned earlier that there are so many different types of non-QM, it's not just one bucket. You even made the point about products with prepayment penalties, and those would certainly behave differently than those without. So are we tracking the various products and coming up with different discount rates and generating cash flows based on that categorization?
Yeah, we're doing our best right now, given the sample size. So one of the things to kind of hammer home here is non-QM is not ubiquitous. There are very different types of loans that make up that category. So we talked about DSCR, we talked about bank statements, but there's things in there like non-wardable condos. There's things in there like self-employed borrowers, right? International buyers as well, right? That make up this bucket of non-QM, and they all have different kind of prepayment profiles based upon that, and then also based upon each individual lender or investor's guidelines. The guidelines here are, again, not ubiquitous. You might have two products with two investors that are kind of, that sound similar, but their guidelines make it that they're not fungible. And another point on the agency side that we probably blew past is the fungibility, right? Like you could take an agency eligible loan and sell it to 20 different people if there is ever an issue with it. Whereas within this non-QM space, because of the lack of the backdrop of, or like that, like standard backdrop, you could get into a spot where there's risk associated with, oh, I thought I delivered to investor X, and nope, now I reread investor Y's guidelines with a magnifying glass, and now I can't send it to investor Y, and you're stuck with the loan. So it's a very, especially for folks who are not bulking to securitization size, and they're, it's like a flow standpoint, it could put you in quite a pickle there.
Sounds like it.
Yeah, that's a great overview, Mike. I think that really sets the stage. One, that, you know, it is not just flip a switch, you know, turn on a non-QM program that you can hedge and easily sell in bulk to the market. But two, that you are really leading us to the forefront of being able to understand the market better. I really appreciate all the work you've been doing. It's helped us understand it better, but also helps us then determine if there is a, you know, more fungible market out there that we can help with in the industry.
Yeah, it's certainly a little bit of a chicken or an egg problem right now. One of the, maybe it's a chicken or the egg, there's more profit margin on these loans typically, but then that brings, there's also increased risk, right, associated with these loans as well. And then you think of some of the things that are happening in the industry where there is an appetite for these loans because of that increased yield on these loans. So you think of, you know, we've heard anecdotally, you know, different REITs, insurance funds, either buying mortgage companies or buying large pieces of mortgage companies to try and get them exposure to this asset sooner in like the process. You never know if this is just some portfolio manager like trend of the year or if it's something here to stay. And I think as we see maybe a more standard kind of a correspondent / investor kind of maybe like stand themselves up as a non-QM buyer, I think that will kind of be like the next domino to fall in terms of getting more market adoption, like maybe like an agency, your standard agency, you know, investor kind of moving into this space next to it and, you know, bidding on loans on a daily basis from a mandatory perspective. That's kind of the next, you know, domino to fall. If that happened, I think you would see a fairly large like pickup in the space, because right now it's the lack of observations, it's the lack of consistency, the lack of timing that I think is kind of holding this piece of the industry from really taking off.
All right, Mike, I know that we're probably running out of time here, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask you this next question. So earlier on, you had used the word subprime crisis as you talked about the CFPB and the introduction of regulations. Do you see the need or do you anticipate the need for further regulations?
You know what? I don't think so. I think we've learned the lessons on the origination front from the last crisis. I think you could even make the argument that we maybe have over-regulated pieces of that part of the market right now. You're not seeing the same type of IO-only weird ARM products. I think we're probably a little bit lucky that the yield curve was so inverted for a long time that we don't have a lot of these teaser periods that are running out right now. I think generally, if you look at the state of homeowners, U.S. housing stock is valued at approximately $48 trillion. $35 trillion of that is equity in homes. So the American borrower, I think, is just on a much different financial footing. And then also, I think our industry has changed for the better in that spot. So I don't think so. But with any of these industries that have parts of them that don't have a standard operating procedure, is there a percentage chance that something goes wrong? Yeah, probably. But I think it's minimal compared to some of the other things that are out there right now.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. You know, you get a lot of, as you start talking about these products, you get a lot of, oh, here we go again, right? But, you know, I feel like we're going into this with eyes wide open much more. And there's always going to be, anytime you're, lending this amount of money, there's always going to be credit risk to a borrower. But you do, not every borrower is the same. So you do have to have some unique products to cover different types of borrowers. And I think this fills that void. It doesn't seem like we're going too overboard at this point.
No, I think it's kind of just shifting based upon how we see the U.S. economy shifting, right? You're seeing more gig work. You're seeing more entrepreneurialism, some small businesses. And I think this product is kind of filling that gap.
Yeah, I've never heard the word side hustle as much as I have over the last 18 months or so. Everyone's talking about their side hustles.
That don't make it onto a W-2. Yep.
I'll come back to income verification.
Income verification. All right. Any other final thoughts on the topic?
No, I just think all lenders need to be considering this. It could be your strategy to not partake in it, but it does seem to be one of the areas of growth out there in the industry. And the folks that we have seen that have been successful are at least putting a lot of time and effort into considering moving into this space. So everybody has to have a plan, even if their plan is to do nothing.
Very much agreed. Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today, Mike.
No, super appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
That's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analyses and insights to help you stay ahead. Don't forget to follow us on LinkedIn and subscribe to our YouTube channel to access our latest video episodes. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thank you for tuning in to Optimal Insights.
Is your technology vendor selling real solutions or just the idea of them? Too often, companies pitch big returns, offer free trials, and promise seamless automation, only to reveal during implementation that the tech doesn't actually exist. At Optimal Blue, we take a different approach. Our AI-powered automation is already live, already delivering, and already saving lenders real dollars. We show you exactly where the ROI comes from and how it reduces risk. No vague timelines, just proven technology that's working in production today. AI at Optimal Blue isn't just about delivering software. It's about empowering lenders to make smarter decisions, operate more efficiently, and stay ahead of the curve. Built around real capital markets challenges, informed by direct engagement with thousands of clients, and focused on delivering measurable value at no additional cost to clients. While others talk about AI, we're delivering it. Innovation that delivers for your bottom line. Learn more at optimalblue.com.